I was standing in the patrol office, all smiles. The adrenaline hadn't worn off yet, and I was still pretty pumped. Earlier in the night, a man tried to kill me. During a large fight that I had responded to by myself because we didn't have any available units, a wannabe gang member out of Indianapolis had decided to try and make his cred by putting a bullet into the responding officer. It had been a very chaotic scene, a large fight in the street in front of the townhouses, and I had walked down the hill between the buildings. They didn't know I was there until I yelled and hit the group with my light. Two things happened at once. A couple of the guys fighting decided to fight me, and the bad guys started shooting. I went down in the pile, and my backup officer, who had peeled off another call, just came around the corner. He thought I'd been shot. He put out officer down over the radio. It took a bit to get the thing handled, but in the end, I came out of that personally with no injuries and a bad guy in custody for attempted murder. My partner and I even broke the confession. I was pumped. That's when the dispatcher walked into the patrol office. They had a weird look on their face. Far from the smiles and the backslapping that I'd been receiving, no, they looked pissed. Here we go, I thought. They're going to light me up for not following some silly radio procedure. But that's not what happened at all. They just gave me a hug and said, "I'm glad you're all right. And in the future, when you get a chance, make sure you let us know you're okay." And they walked back into dispatch. I didn't understand what they had to deal with sitting in that windowless room listening to something happen miles away that they had no control over. I think my smile went away right about then. It's time to start telling our own stories. I'm Steve Kellums, and welcome to Blue Canary. Dispatch is one of the most important parts of the emergency management system. They're the first ones to talk to the public, they answer questions, and send help where needed. It's also the one we tend to forget about. To help us understand more about dispatch and what they do, I talked with Adam Tim. Adam Tim worked as a dispatcher for LAPD for 10 years before starting his own training company, The Healthy Dispatcher. He's gone on to provide international instruction for 911 operators, as well as becoming a best-selling author, writing 4 books on leadership, stress, and 911 dispatching. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk with me today.
A pleasure to be here, Steve. Thank you.
Let's start by letting our audience know a little bit about you, your background and experience in communications, how you got involved into it, and where you spent your early formative years.
Sure. I was a frontline telecommunicator for the Los Angeles Police Department Communications Division for a little over 10 years. And like many who get into communications or 911 emergency communications, I followed the job posting for an interesting job. At LAPD, they call the role police service representative. The extent of my understanding of the new job was that I was going to work for the city of Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles is a good employer, good benefits. And I work for this department called the Los Angeles Police Department.
Sounds like a bait and switch.
I know. Yeah. So I was 22 years old and I was not happy in my current job. So I applied, I took the civil service exam, and 10 months later, the job offer came in and I said, okay, let's do this. I was not prepared. As a result of that kind of nonchalant acquiescence to the new job, I was not prepared for what I was about to get into.
I would suspect being a dispatcher for LAPD, you got thrown into the deep end of the pool right off the bat.
Yeah. I didn't know this until I left the dispatch center and started my training company. And I started getting out into dispatch centers and talking with other dispatchers across the country. But LAPD Communications is one of the largest and busiest 911 agencies in the country. We have 600 line level dispatchers, approximately 60 supervisors processing 3 million calls for service each year. I talk with agencies who process 50,000 calls a year, which we do in less than a month at LAPD. So it was, I didn't realize it, but it was baptism by fire.
So what did a typical day of yours look like? And I guess this would be typical of most dispatchers across the United States, but what are you doing?
I would say that large agencies, the typical daily work mix is different than smaller agencies. Large agencies tend to separate the jobs, meaning when you come in for your work shift, you're assigned either the phones or at a large agency, you're assigned either the phones for the entire day or working the radio for the entire day. So we're cross-trained on both functions. And because there's so much work, either on the phones or on the radio at a large agency, the jobs are separated. At smaller agencies, you'll have the telecommunicator assigned to both the phones and the radio. And that poses different challenges with multitasking because they might be on a 911 call and then the road keys the mic and says, show me code 6 on stolen vehicle. And you have to be able to either write things down or put that officer code 6 or at scene while working with a 911 caller. So it's a different mix. I can speak from my own experience at LAPD that if I was assigned the phones for the day, I'm either assigned the non-emergency line for the entire day, or I'm assigned the 911 lines for the entire day. If I'm working 911, then every call that comes in is someone in the city of LA who has dialed 911 from their phone. And these statistics tend to hold true across the country. With the LAPD, 70% of all calls placed to 911 are non-emergency in nature. When you're assigned to 911, you're triaging and you're either handling the emergency calls, the urgent and life-threatening calls, creating calls for service, dispatching them out to the officers in the field, or you're transferring people to the non-emergency line. If you're assigned the non-emergency line, you catch it, you clean it. You have to deal with every single caller that comes through your line because it's likely that they've already been triaged and they've been waiting on hold for some time for their non-emergency matter.
And that's all also having to figure out appropriate responses to what those vast variety of calls.
Yeah, it's the training program at LAPD is about 12 to 18 months. And so you, during that time, which I've found also as I got out of the center and started talking with other agencies, that's a very long time. And my theory on it is that because of the high volume nature of the work at a large center for a large police agency, if it's not a long training, you can't expect the person to feel ready for the job. We do have to provide customer service. Sure. They are customers. You're talking the citizen through how they can receive service for what they might believe is an urgent matter, but due to the system of prioritization, which is very clearly stated in policy and procedure, it's not to us. Like, and that's a delicate matter. How do you talk with a caller in that way?
Yeah, every time someone calls 911, it's an emergency in their mind, no matter exactly what it is, whether it's the cat stuck in the tree, the house is on fire, grandma's dying. It's all an emergency to them.
Exactly. There is a system of prioritization around how you process calls or broadcasts on the radio as well. So if an officer is code 6, it takes a certain level of precedence because if they pull someone over and the call quickly goes sideways, we need to know exactly where they are. And we need surrounding units or units in the surrounding area to also know where that patrol car is. Now, there's also calls coming through from call takers. If a call taker has a code 3 call, so highest priority, urgent and life-threatening call, the policy is that they create that call for service and they are also required to go out on the air and broadcast it. And so this is the call taker taking over the dispatcher's air. And if there is an available unit, meaning a basic patrol car that patrols that particular beat and zone area, the call taker is responsible for assigning and showing that unit en route. If there is not a call or a car available, a patrol car available, a unit available, then it falls back on the dispatcher who's monitoring that frequency to find a unit and to assign and show them en route. And so when an urgent life-threatening call comes out, that's going to take precedence as well. And the dispatcher is monitoring and jumping in when they need to. And it's all very clear as you learn radio etiquette, as you learn how to work a frequency as a dispatcher and how to jump on a frequency as a call taker.
You got to be the king of multitasking, right?
Oh, truly. Yeah. You really have to have a mind for how the work is, how it's flowing, how it's created. And there's also trusting in your team members that if they're coming out with a code 3 call, that it's actually a real deal and that you should just let them handle it. And this is crazy. There is 8,000 officers at the time. I left LAPD in 2013, but at the time there was 8,000 officers that worked in the LAPD. On any given shift, you might have 2,000 of them out running around on 28 different patrol frequencies. And unless you can be assured that everyone knows the radio language and knows how to conduct themselves with the same level of etiquette, it's very confusing, because on one day I might be assigned Central Division. On the next day, I'm going to be assigned 77th Division. We're all one department. So I can't spend the first couple of hours of my shift getting used to how the central officers speak differently than the 77th officers. And so there was this kind of consistency on the air.
It's training then becomes paramount.
Oh my
gosh.
You
have to be trained properly. And you travel across the United States and you train internationally, even train dispatchers to how to do this. You said earlier that the training program at LAPD was long. And I know this is a loaded question. I know it going into it. Yeah. But where is the training level for dispatchers across the United States?
It's varied. And for the listeners, I only got to the first 10 years of my career in my intro. So I spent 10 and a half years as a frontline dispatcher. And in 2013, I left LAPD to start my own training and consulting company, which is called The Healthy Dispatcher. And since then, I've just been crisscrossing the country doing training classes, conference breakout sessions and keynotes, and consulting specifically for 911. That's all I do. I'm very niche specific. I occasionally get a request like, do you also work with officers? And occasionally I'll have officers in my classes, but it's very rare. My message is very pointed towards those who work in 911. And what I've seen, back to your question around training, is that it really depends on the state, and even within the state, it depends on the locality. I'm sad to report that less than 30 states out of 50 have minimum training requirements at the state level for 911 telecommunicators.
So you're saying that there are states out there in which someone could get hired, walk into a room, they can sit down in front of a console, and they can say, here's a keyboard, here's the phone, call me if you have a problem.
Technically, they could do that. And thankfully, it's not that bad. But there are agencies that are so short-staffed that when they hire somebody, they will give them a cursory, like, two-week crash course on how to be a 911 telecommunicator. And typically, like I said, with a small agency, they're both answering 911 calls and working the radio at the same time. They'll sit with someone for 2 weeks, and then they're on their own.
What types of training should they be getting?
Oh man. So coming from LAPD, it's like we spent the first 6 to 8 weeks just in the class, not even listening to calls. California Post has X amount of hours that you have to have in order to be a certified telecommunicator. And so we needed to get the California Post hours, first of all. And then LAPD has a bunch of classroom stuff, because there's so many crime types and call codes that you have to be able to understand. So if a caller calls in and they're telling, I have a neighbor who's threatening me and I need the police out here right now. And instantly, if I don't know better, if I don't have the training, I might create an urgent and life-threatening call because of your neighbor who is in close proximity to you. So this is the story I'm building in my mind.
Sure.
There's a neighbor who's very close to you. They're threatening you and your life is in danger. The next question is, can you tell me exactly what's going on? Oh, I have this ongoing dispute with my neighbor about a fence line. And a couple of years ago, they dug up my fence and they dug some post holes about one foot into my property line. And they called me yesterday and said that they were filing a civil suit against me. That's a very different experience, or a very different matter than my neighbor threatening me.
Yeah. And we've seen those instances like that across the United States where the officer arriving at the scene didn't have all of the information of the call for whatever reason, and mm-hmm. ended up making decisions there that were probably the wrong decisions because they came at it completely differently. If I'm showing up to the call as a patrol officer to deal with a property dispute about a fence line, I'm going to approach that much differently than thinking the neighbor is trying to kill the person in the house.
Yeah, exactly. Back to your question about training, it's multifaceted. So the better agencies, when it comes to 911, the training starts, or the vetting process, let's say, for a 911 professional, a new hire, begins with the recruitment process. It begins with the job posting. And I've written a couple of books specifically for 911. One is called Dispatcher Stress, 50 Lessons on Beating the Burnout. It's for working with the challenges of the job itself, the burnout and mental health awareness. And my most recent book is called People-Driven Leadership, How the Best 911 Centers Inspire Positive Change. And that book I released after doing case study interviews for 3 to 4 years as I was crisscrossing the country. And I would hear these interesting stories of centers that were great places to work, of center managers and directors who had taken toxic work cultures and completely turned them around and made them these exemplary centers. And I got really curious about what these centers do and did differently than the other centers that I was finding to be the norm, like caustic work environments, constantly revolving door, trouble retaining employees. And that's when I say the best communication centers. The best communication centers have something in common. They approach the work. They approach hiring, recruitment, training, recognition, and acknowledgement of their existing personnel. They approach all of these elements of the work in a very different way than the rest. And so it starts with your recruitment process, your job posting, because if you're not hiring for the right fit, guess what? You're going to have downstream problems. You're going to bring someone in who, after 2 weeks, they're like, I thought this is going to be different. And then they quit. And then you got to go back out to the pool, if there was a pool in the first place, and you got to start the whole process again.
What kind of people are you looking for then as dispatchers? When you talk about that hiring process and getting the right people, what are the right people?
So there's two schools of thought on this. The old way was that we needed people who bled blue. They were public safety minded already. Possibly they had family members who are already officers or firefighters, or they're following in the lineage of family members who are already in dispatch. We also say you have to be able to thrive under pressure and be a multitasker. There's some pre-screening checks and tests that agencies can do to see, can you type fast? Can you process a variety of bits of information quickly and at the same time? And what we're seeing a trend towards, though, now more recently, is people hiring for, yeah, we need to know that they can multitask and type at least 40 words per minute, but we're seeing a trend toward a more customer service orientation. And there's an agency who the director is a good friend of mine. Years ago, it's been 10 years since they started doing this, they started to find really great fit for folks who worked at Starbucks or had previously worked in a high volume fast food restaurant working on the drive-through lane, because they're wearing a headset, they're processing a lot of demands, they're looking for a new challenge that where the stakes are a little bit higher and they can actually make a difference, and they find their way to 911 through a job posting.
That's very interesting.
So once you have a good fit, a good training program is structured. You'd be very surprised to learn how many 911 centers don't even have a structured training program. They don't even have a training manual. They just they indoctrinate new people into the center and center culture the way that it's always been done. They put them with one of their more tenured folks and say, here you go. It's basically job shadowing. And they might have some notes. They might have a Word doc that they've been adding things to for the last 20 years, but they don't actually have a formalized training program. So I would say, and you might think it funny to say, start with the formalized training process.
That's public safety in general. I find that's one of the things that I talk about a lot with on the patrol side or corrections officers. They have no formalized or structured training program. And so I call it the Jesus method of field training. You put both hands together and you pray that it works out. And so it doesn't surprise me at all. But it is unfortunate, because just having a structured program in and of itself, no matter what the program, is going to put you leaps and bounds ahead of what you were doing.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure this is in your time as an FTO, that people who feel prepared for their job are more likely to feel fulfilled and succeed in their role and thereby stick around longer. And the research in 911 conclusively shows this, that the agencies that provide better training have better people who stick around longer because they feel prepared for the job.
Blue Canary is here to help you tell your stories, and I couldn't do that without the help of some very generous sponsors. Let's take a quick break to hear from one.
The Legal Liability Risk Management Institute is the nation's largest provider of liability and risk management services in the United States. Our goal is to help reduce liability, reduce lawsuits, and enhance officer performance. Regardless of the size of your agency, we have a risk management solution. You may contact us at www.llrmi.com or call 317-386-8325.
Help your team rise to increasing expectations with Agency 360's cloud-based software. Whether it is for the training of new employees or annual performance evaluations, Agency 360 can help trainers and supervisors streamline documentation, create consistency, and communicate clearly. Help retention by setting the tone and culture early with Agency 360. Learn more at agency360.com. That's AGENCY360.com.
We'll talk about prepared, and you've written a couple of books now about stress within it. What are some of the issues, those stress issues that dispatchers are having to deal with on a fairly regular basis? And I'm sure we'll get to this, but what's some of the hardest things that they have to do on the job?
I think you might be surprised to learn that there's been several studies that have asked 911 professionals to rank their top stressors in the role. And of the top 10 stressors, 8 of them have nothing to do with the actual work itself. In fact, like working with callers in the public, dealing with urgent field situations on the radio, rank low in the top 10 when it comes to the amount of perceived stress by those who do the job. The ones that rank higher are things like lack of recognition, dispatch being the scapegoat for the agency when things go sideways, no follow-up, not being included in debriefings of incidents that were challenging, and they all point to leadership. So the implied message in these findings is that if we can lead our people, provide them the resources that they need, the acknowledgement that they need as high-performing team members in this organization, that they will succeed. And the type of person who finds their way into 911, first of all, they're mostly type A perfectionists. Second of all, they're mostly heroic caregivers to the world. They will put themselves aside for the world that they're helping. They will sacrifice a piece of themselves for the peace of the situation. And the problem with that is that they will not ask for help. They will not program downtime into their daily mix, and they'll just keep on keeping on. And you couple that disposition with the stigma around mental health and prioritizing self-care in public safety in general, and you have potential problems there. And I find that the main thing that we need as those who work in public safety to be willing to do is say it's okay to not be okay, that it's okay to ask for help, and that it's okay to say no to that next shift, or say no to the family member who always is asking me to do stuff on my days off, which are very limited because we're working mandatory overtime, 16-hour shifts, 6, 7, 8 days in a row at our center. And so if we are prepared, meaning we have the mental space and we're prioritizing our wellness, we are going to be less likely to fall victim to the rigors of the job, meaning a tough call where we experience vicarious trauma. We'll be less likely to push ourselves towards burnout and compassion fatigue because we are adopting a proactive stance to our own wellness. So that's on the individual level. There is also an organizational component. We need to provide resources. Every agency should have a well-publicized EAP, employee assistance program. Every agency should have a peer support program. Every agency should have a formalized critical incident stress debriefing program for major incidents. Every agency should include dispatch and give them the option of being a part of the debrief, not necessarily making it mandatory, but including them on the inside. Every single agency should try everything that they can to close the loop for dispatchers, call takers who are sitting in a windowless communication center, not knowing if their efforts on a 3-minute call that was very traumatic for them made a difference, because they never hear anything down the line.
That's the biggest thing to me. And that's the one that I've always taken away from it, is you talked about the type A personalities and having to deal with the stresses and those high risk types of calls as they come up. Being in the street, being on those patrol cars or being on foot, you can do something. And I've always wondered just how the dispatchers handled having to sit in that windowless room and listen to all of these things going on that's outside of their control when we're control freaks. That has to be absolutely, it has to be terrifying.
Yeah, we don't handle it. We suck it up and go on to the next call. I find that many 911 professionals tend to keep themselves very busy on their days off so that they don't have to think about what they're carrying around with them for years and years and years. And if you listen to radio traffic and calls with that have been made public, you marvel at the composure that every 911 professional brings into those crazy instances. You've got a caller that's yelling and screaming, and then you've got a call taker who is conducting themselves with the utmost professionalism and being this kind of still point for the caller. Same with the officers in an urgent field situation. So an officer keys the mic and says, "Officer needs help taking shots," and the dispatcher gets on the air and puts that broadcast out, and it's just this depiction of calmness in the storm. It's really amazing.
You said something earlier about leadership, and I want to go back to that. Organization and leadership are really important to make all this stuff happen.
Yeah.
Leadership within the communications divisions, are they coming up? Are they other dispatchers that are becoming leaders? How are we ending up with those leaders in those dispatch centers?
Yeah, so the Better Comm centers are typically civilian run, and these are civilians who have done time under the headset. They have worked a console. They've either been a frontline telecommunicator or a supervisor. They have done time doing the job. And as a result, when they ascend the hierarchy and become a deputy director or executive director of their center, they lead in a different way. And in my training classes, I talk a lot about how everybody is a leader. And in fact, if we identify ourselves as a leader as early on in our career as possible, there's going to be a different level of quality and professionalism that comes out in our work. And the best leaders in 911 are great about pushing leadership down the line and contextualizing leadership from that perspective. And we're moving away from the old command and control authoritarian approach to leadership that I think used to be the way things were when police agencies were predominantly identified as paramilitary. I think we still say that most police agencies are paramilitary organizations, meaning there's chain of command, there's roles that are like sergeants and lieutenants. But I've found that there's a trend away from the command and control model and towards this kind of people-driven model. And you see the authors like Captain Michael Abershoff, who wrote that great book, It's Your Ship, where the best military leaders never really relied on their hierarchy and their title to get things done. They actually came down from on high and worked with all levels, ranks, and files in a very personal approach. And I'm seeing that approach works best in 911. And I think not surprisingly.
And now a lot of agencies, though, will assign someone from the patrol side to be in charge of that 911 center. How's that work out?
I have seen that creates difficulties, both for the the sworn personnel who is assigned communications and everyone beneath them. Interesting statistic, in the state of California, there are over 400 911 centers, and 60% of them are embedded within either a police or sheriff's agency. And what we see in the state of California is that creates problems because civilian leadership can only be elevated to a certain level, and then they answer to the sheriff, or they answer ultimately to the police chief or one of the lieutenants or the sergeants who are the ultimate decision-making party. When you have a great leader in a sergeant or a lieutenant, meaning they are imbued with true leadership qualities, they know how to treat their people, they know what they don't know, and they know how to say, I don't know that, and they defer to the people who know better, it's no problem. I don't want the message that I'm about to share to mean that every 911 agency that is led by sworn personnel is a bad place to work, because that's not true. But if you have a sworn personnel who is assigned communications because they're being punished or they're being taken off the road or they're on light duty and the only assignment we have left is you're being thrown into communications, their unwillingness or lack of desire, first of all, to be there manifests as an unwillingness to learn the job. And that's a problem because 911 work is vastly, vastly different than working the road. And it's with a different group. It's predominantly civilian employees. 70 to 80% of the employees in 911 in general across the country are women employees. That's different than working with predominantly men on the road who have a different way of working. And there's a lot of ex-military in police as well. It's a very different mix just from the those variables. And then you're assigned, you're thrown into dispatch and you're like, gosh, And as I'm saying this, the story comes to mind. There was a center in Texas where the sergeant assigned communications was exactly this situation. He was being punished. He didn't want to be in communications. And every single day, and I learned from the operations manager, who was the sergeant's lieutenant, meaning the number two in command. And the operations manager had done time in dispatch. She worked her way up to ops manager. She was the de facto leader at the center. She was the people who everyone came to with their problems because they knew that the sergeant was basically not there. They were clocked out, but retired in place. And the ops manager was very open with the sergeant and saying, hey, you might not want to spend the first 4 hours of your shift eating your lunch, reading the newspaper in your windowed office adjacent to the communications center floor, because your people are working mandatory overtime shifts and it's really tough right now. And this is an actual quote when the ops manager brought just another complaint to the sergeant. Sergeant says, I don't give a fuck what they think. They complain about everything anyway. That's a direct quote. Like that in my assessment encapsulates what's wrong in the most egregious cases. You have someone who doesn't want to be there. They're not open. They're not receptive. And they have the ultimate decision-making power to make life better. You might be unsurprised to learn that center had a toxic work culture, had difficulty with retention and hiring and recruitment, all the things that have become the norm in 911.
Also, one of the things we know is that work teams take on the personalities of their leaders. So if that's their leader's personality, pretty quickly, their interactions with public are probably going to be the same.
Yeah, absolutely. The centers are better places to work because the people who know better than someone who's doing a 2-year stint with oversight around a business that they don't know anything about.
Adam, as we wrap this up, I'm curious, what is one thing that you would like the people outside of the dispatch center to understand about what's going on inside the dispatch center?
It is a vastly different type of work We wrongly assume that because we are supporting the road, we're supporting the officers in the field, we're supporting the EMTs, we're supporting the firefighters, that it's the same. But it isn't. As this conversation up to this point has pointed to, the work is different. The perceptions of how the work is done and about the work are different. And visit your dispatch center. Come into the communication center. Shadow your 911 professionals. They would love to see you. You'd be surprised at how few folks from the road actually come into the dispatch center and plug in and monitor calls and really get into it. We would occasionally have officers who would come into the communications division dispatch center at LAPD. They were usually doing their rookie stint, and they would come in, and just in 1 hour of listening to the radio, in 1 hour of listening to the phones, they would emerge with such a level of respect for the work that this person is doing on a daily basis. And Steve, you said it before, you can turn it off. You can go and you can say you're on code 7, which was our term in LAPD, for lunch, and you're not available for calls. When you are tethered to a console as a 911 professional, you can't shut it off. You have to go call after call, incident after incident, and you might touch 100 incidents in a shift that out on the road, you touched maybe 4 or 5. Yeah, you're out there in the midst of it, and that poses new challenges. But being on the other end of things, we're literally bathing in a much higher frequency of incidents. And in order to be one department, one agency, one badge, as my friend and colleague, Captain Jeremy Hill in Amarillo says, we need to be able to understand how the work we do is different and similar and how we're all supporting each other.
Is there also one thing you'd like to say to those dispatchers and communication specialists that are listening to this podcast?
You guys make a difference. The public safety apparatus does not work without you. And the job that you do is important. And even though that you're unsung at times and it can be difficult to come upon the recognition and that you so deserve, we see you. We see you. The officers in the road see you and appreciate you. The firefighters, the paramedics rolling out to each call. We can't do the job without you. And you are a leader.
Adam, thank you very much.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Steve.
And that's the story we have to tell. Thank you for joining. As always, I'm curious what questions you're getting asked. What isn't the news covering? What story needs to be told? Connect with me at bluecanarypodcast@gmail.com.